Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, our guest is Michael Graziano, author of Rethinking Consciousness, A Scientific Theory of Subjective Experience, published in September by Norton. Michael is professor of psychology and neuroscience at Princeton. He's written four other neuroscience books, and his work has appeared in The Atlantic, New York Times, The Huffington Post, and many other periodicals. And his lab at Princeton focuses on a theory labeled the attention schema. So Rethinking Consciousness explores the world in which we live and how that world is represented in our mind. It's not only the perception of reality, but our perception of that perception that drives the experience which we call consciousness. Neurons fire, the one that fire like warriors, drive our attention and thus give rise to the ideas that we exist and that we are paying attention to something or other. So with that rather simplistic introduction, welcome, Michael, and thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So I have hundreds of questions, and I feel compelled to ask as my first, and we talked a little bit about this before the show began. Because it's, you know, it's the title of your book, and because it's the main, let's say, hard problem is, you know, what is consciousness?
Right. So this is an excellent question to start with. People have been studying consciousness for a very long time, and the notion of what to study has changed over the years. If you go back maybe 100 years, people used to study the content inside our heads. When they used the word consciousness, they meant what is that stream of consciousness, the impressions and the sensory information, the notions of, about ourselves, general knowledge about the world, all this stuff boiling through our heads moment by moment. That's what people generally thought of as consciousness. But philosophers and scientists have really focused on a different, much more specific question now, and that is, how do we have a subjective experience of anything at all, big or small, abstract or concrete, whether you're talking about an experience of looking at a color or an experience of a poke on the skin or experiencing thinking deep thoughts about yourself, whatever it is, how do we have a subjective experience of anything at all? I think the reason why there's a shift in focus like that is because of computer technology. People have realized that you can have machines that process information, that have enormous amounts of information flowing through them, but those machines are not necessarily subjectively conscious. So now the philosophical question is, how is it that people have this subjective experience that we call consciousness?
And it's funny, all my life, if I ever, you know, and I'm thinking about it with the tool I'm trying to learn about, all my life, I've just distilled it to the fact that I'm aware of my own existence. Is that close? But that doesn't seem as close as I thought it would be with what you just said. I always just looked at it that way. I'm aware that I exist.
That's right. That is what I guess you could say a kind of a previous view. But the problem is your own existence is just another kind of content. It's just another piece of information. So how is it that you're aware of anything at all, whether it's aware of yourself and your own existence or aware of the stuff around you? Or to put it this way, we know how to build a computer that has self-information, right? The computer can have all kinds of information about itself and its own existence and where it is and how it functions, but that doesn't make the computer conscious, right? So there's still this question, where does the subjective experience component come from, whether it's experiencing yourself or experiencing some aspect of the outside world? So there is a deeper mystery there than just self-awareness.
Well, before we dig down further into your title and subtitle, which is a good way to do this, I think, because you obviously spent a long time thinking about that. So what is the difference between consciousness, I'm going to say in your mind, what is the difference between consciousness and cognition, you know, the process of integrating the feelings and senses that you perceive? What is cognition then?
So many people think of cognition as basically the brain computing information, usually at a kind of higher level. So a lot of cognition, of course, is still quite mysterious, but a lot of it, at least the general principles, are understood. So think of cognition as sort of like a computer crunching information.
Well, so, okay, go ahead, sorry.
And so, again, we still have this problem that cognition is not the same as consciousness. A lot of what goes on in our cognition, we're not conscious of. And so you still have this question, what is it? What is the extra piece that makes us have this conscious experience of some pieces of information in our head and not other pieces of information? So that's kind of the heart of the question that people have been asking for a while now, and that this theory and my book try to address that particular aspect, that particular question.
So when you go back in time to the classical views of consciousness, which distilled, again, would be like awareness of internal or external existence, which was, you know, if you go to Wikipedia, that's basically what it's going to start with. You're not disagreeing with that as a definition, or are you?
Well, I think the terminology has changed. So I'm certainly not disagreeing that we are, we have a constant stream of content, a stream of information in us about ourselves and about the outside world. There's no doubt that exists. William James called it the stream of consciousness. He actually coined that term. So that certainly exists. It's just the terminology has kind of shifted a bit. People have really focused on a different part of the question. And again, I think it's because of computer technology. There was a time when people thought that if you could somehow build something that had all that information content in it, then it would be a conscious thing. But now we know that's not true, because we can actually build computers that have memory, that have self-knowledge, that take in information about the outside world, that integrate it all together, but they're not really conscious. And so there's obviously something else that's missing there. And the whole field of neuroscience, psychology, and philosophy of consciousness has kind of been honing in more and more on this one specific piece. So it's not really the point is, if you could figure out how you have a subjective feel, a conscious experience of even the most trivial thing, like the color green, if you could figure that out, then you could generalize it and apply it to our conscious experience of anything in our heads, and the whole problem would be solved.
Well, I guess using your title, because as I said, it's, you know, several words, so using your title as kind of a roadmap of our discussion, how do we, before we get to the prefix, how do we actually think about consciousness?
So, are you asking how do people in general think about their own consciousness, or how should we as scientists think about consciousness?
I guess definitionally, because, okay, yeah, the book is Rethinking Consciousness, which the other question I have is how do we rethink, you know, rethinking. But the idea of you're saying rethinking consciousness, do you mean something discrete in the sense that thinking about consciousness is, for my mind, it's very difficult to wrap my head around the idea of thinking about something using the very tool that I'm trying to explicate. You know what I mean? I mean, if I think about my own awareness, I'm thinking about something using the very tool that I'm attempting to understand.
Right. Yes. So one possible way to get at this, again, if you think of consciousness in the most general possible sense, of all the stuff in your head and all your thinking ability. That's a very general, very broad concept of what consciousness is. That's maybe also a very popular way to think about it. And it's, as I said, a way that has been around at least for 100 years since William James began speculating about this. But that is really not how people have been trying to tackle the question. So most of what goes on in your head is not conscious. And therefore, it isn't really a problem of using your consciousness to understand your consciousness. You can use your rational, logical mind to try to understand one piece of your mind. And that's, I think, maybe what the answer to that specific question is. So let me try to put it this way. There's kind of two different views of our experience of the world. And one is maybe a naive view that what we experience really is out there. The world as the brain presents it to us is the world out there. And there's a second view, which is correct, that neuroscientists and psychologists have been gradually figuring out over the decades that the brain doesn't actually give us a particularly accurate rendition of the world around us or an accurate rendition of itself. Instead, what the brain does is build descriptions, models they're sometimes called, or simulations. They're bundles of information that describe things around us. And those models, they're cartoonish, they're simplistic, they're never really accurate. They're meant to be efficient and quick and dirty and useful for survival, but they're never really scientifically accurate. And so when you look around at the outside world and you see colors and you see nice, clear borders and shapes and so on, that's largely constructed inside your head. So color, of course, is always a good example. Color is a simplification. It's a construct of your brain. The reality is much more complex. It's this sort of there is no color in the real world. There's only very rich reflectance spectrums. So the same thing is true of ourselves, that we have these very simplistic cartoonish models, these simulations or understandings of ourselves, but they're not terribly accurate. So the brain has constructed a cartoonish understanding of itself. And that's probably at the heart of this mystery of consciousness, why we look at ourselves and think, gosh, there's some hard to understand deep mystery there. It's because we're getting a very fuzzy cartoonish view of ourselves through introspection.
It's so funny because when you start talking about this in depth, it always reminds me of when I was 18 or 19 in my dorm room in an altered state of consciousness talking about this stuff at 3 o'clock in the morning. You know what I mean? But so, like, for example, the idea that many philosophers and scientists contend that what we actually believe we're perceiving is illusory. For example, you don't know if I have consciousness by talking to me. Actually, you don't even know if I exist. I could be a construct of your own imagination. But at the same point, if I was like what is considered now, not the way it was originally, but now the way people think of a Turing test, have you reached the point yet, or will you ever reach the point in this discussion with me that I actually do exist, or I actually have consciousness? Can you do that?
So, I think that there's this perspective in which you don't know if anything around you exists. This has been around since the ancient Greeks. I think what neuroscientists and psychologists have kind of gotten to is not quite so extreme a view. In other words, there is stuff out there. There is reality. And you look around you and, you know, there's a coffee cup next to you. There really is a coffee cup. And there's aspects to the world that can be objectively measured. Instrumentation can pick it up and you can describe it mathematically and so on. But there's also the version of it that you personally perceive. And the version that you personally perceive is a simplification of reality. It isn't the actual real world around you. It's not totally divorced from the world around you. There are people and objects around you, but what you see is a kind of a simplistic version of it. And I gave the example of color was probably the first example of that that was really well understood. But the same thing can be true of many other aspects of the world around us. So the brain is giving us a simulation of the real thing, and we are walking through and experiencing that simulation. And the simulation gives us crucial information that allows us to get along in the world and survive without feeding us too much detail. But through our scientific and intellectual minds, we can discover other aspects of that world out there. So I think this is part of what's going on, that the mind, the brain has constructed a simple kind of cartoonish story about itself. And the story is that we have a kind of non-physical essence inside of us, a semi-magical essence inside of us that understands and knows. That's the brain's simplified version of what it's doing. The reality is much more complex and technical, and involves neurons and synapses and computations. But the brain's simplistic self model is there's some kind of essence, consciousness essence inside of me.
Well, so, okay, I've taken this side road, which I wasn't really going to do, but it's fascinating. But you've brought me back to it because in your book, which is really, really great, what you do is you bring us back into our time, or perhaps, and you do at times the future time. But so that brings me back deductively to your title, because you put the prefix re, so rethinking consciousness sounds to me as if you're attempting, which I think you are in the book, and with your schema, attention schema, to create a new paradigm with regard to the definition and study of consciousness. Is that why we're rethinking it?
Yeah, I mean, I think the title was sort of had multiple meanings to it, and that's definitely one of the meanings, that the way people have traditionally thought of it, maybe we have to put aside and think it anew. The typical approach to consciousness is this idea of a hard problem, which Chalmers wrote about and popularized. So the idea of the hard problem is that there's some essence inside of us that we can never understand, and that's non-physical, and that's our consciousness. But there's a second way to think it through, which is maybe there is no hard problem. Maybe the question in front of us is, why does the human brain think that there is a hard problem?
Hmm.
Why does it arrive at that conclusion? This is kind of the topic of the book. Why is it that the brain machine, this biological machine that computes information, why does it think that it has a hard problem of consciousness? And if you can answer that, then you've answered the whole thing. And so this is one aspect of the rethinking.
Well, if we keep drilling down to the subtitle, and you talk about a scientific theory, you know, Heisenberg said, direct knowledge of what is real is essentially beyond the scope of science. Yet you're proposing that exact thing. And once again, I think you're standing on the shoulders of giants. But nonetheless, it sounds like you're contradicting what Heisenberg... Well, you obviously are, because you're proposing a scientific theory, and he's saying that's impossible.
Well, I'm not sure he said that you can't have scientific theories. But certainly in the domain of quantum mechanics, it's very hard. His point was that we don't know the actual reality. But a scientific theory can, you can still have a scientific theory. It can still be useful. And I think part of the point of what I'm doing here in this book, what my research group is doing, is not so much trying to figure out what we're trying to do is figure out what is this probably inaccurate but built-in, evolutionarily built-in way that the brain thinks about itself. And so we're kind of asking, what is the nature of the simulation that we live in, that our brains supply for us. So it, actually, we're not so much asking about reality as asking about how does the brain reconstruct and make up a reality for itself.
Well, what about, again, going off on a side road, which I want to do, what about the concept that, because you mentioned quantum theory, quantum mechanics, what about the concept that by observing the very thing we wish to study, the observation itself changes the nature of that thing? And it's really true in my mind, and there I say in my mind, it's the only place I can go is inside this wetware. So if by starting to take a look at it closely, am I bouncing it around like with an electron, knowing where it is but not knowing its acceleration, or vice versa? Am I messing around with it while I'm looking, because I'm looking at it so closely?
Well, I think, for example, we can study how the brain controls excuse me, we can study how the brain controls movement. And that, in a sense, is like one part of the brain studying a different part. We can study how the brain processes visual input. And again, that's something that we can get a pretty good handle on. That's, in a sense, the scientific, cognitive, higher-order parts of the brain studying the lower-order sensory parts of the brain. And I think consciousness, this subjective experience, may be a lower-order process than people think it is, and I think it is studyable. I think that the cognitive and intellectual parts of the brain can probe that mystery, but I do agree with you that it's very hard to think about. I have often thought that there's almost like a black hole that blocks people from thinking about it.
Yeah,
so when I talk about this subject and I lay out some logic, if I use different terminology and talk about parts of a car or something, but use exactly the same logic, people know exactly what I'm talking about. And all I need to do is change the words and start referring to the mind, all of a sudden people get mystified. So it's there's something intrinsically hard for people when they think about their own minds.
It's funny, for some reason when you said that, it reminds me of how, you know, where the optic nerve exits the eye, you know, you're losing a little portion of your sight, but everyone just kind of forgets about it.
That's right.
It's funny.
Well, that's a good example of the brain constructing its own version of reality around you.
That's pretty cool. Oh, well, so that brings me to, okay, and that's the last words that we need to discuss with regard to the title. We're still on the title, but I think it's great because I think that's great. But so, okay, so lastly, you talk about subjective experience. And subjective essentially means that it's viewed by somebody but doesn't necessarily reflect reality. So is there such a thing with regard to your study and your lab and the work you've done over the past good portion of your life? Is there something that you could conceive of that would be objective experience?
No, I think experiences, we're always locked in our own subjective experience. I mean, we can collect data on the objective world, but then, of course, we always subjectively experience the data.
Well, So if you're looking at, say, something... If you're looking at something like, say, based on Gödel's theory of incompleteness, say, so suppose you have a machine that can repair all machines. What if that machine breaks? How does it repair itself?
I don't know. I mean, I think that's a very fascinating philosophical question. I think one of the things that happens, especially in this field of consciousness, is people tend to come up with these philosophical conundrums.
Yeah.
And the problem with these conundrums is that you can't actually build them and test it. And so they're not quite so useful scientifically. And what I've done, what my lab group has done, we've really been focused on something that you can build scientifically. So a lot of the thought experiments have not been super interesting to us. I guess my response is, well, you build it, and then we can talk about it.
Well, it's funny. I mean, yes, that's definitely true. But I would disagree with you. I would say the work you do seems at least in the book, it seems to me to be objective, because you're mapping the brain, you're talking about people. Oh, your excellent analogy of the, which is great for me, because you know, you'll know, I mean, the way I think about him, you have the picture on one side, right side is Trump, left side is Clinton, and rather than those two images merging, you'll see Clinton sometimes, and then you'll see Trump sometimes over a period of minutes. And hopefully, well, actually, I don't want to see either of them. But
that's actually quite funny, because in the book, you're misremembering. It's actually Yoda and Darth Vader, and somehow in your mind you mapped that onto Clinton and Bush.
I think it is Clinton. I think it's Clinton and Trump. It's not in your book. I got to look it up.
Which is Darth Vader, though?
That's okay, I got it. I got it. Okay, I understand now. Well, okay.
But anyway, yes, you're exactly right about the substance.
Well, so, yeah, there you go, perception. But you're they're still in there. yeah, what I was getting at was, yes, you use electrodes, you map the brain, you talk about neurons that supersede other neurons. Which allows us to think about the bird, but at the same time know that our arm is itching and know that there might be someone behind us bringing us a glass of water as we request it. But because this neuron, like I said in the beginning, like the warrior overriding neuron or cluster, is allowing us to perceive in such a way as I believe it leads towards the attention schema theory, correct?
Yes. So certainly we think that that attention, or this tendency for the brain to focus its processing resources on some things and process them in great depth at the expense of processing all the rest of the world around us. So this roving attention that moves from item to item, this is the heart of consciousness. This is probably why consciousness evolved in the first place. It's part of the way that we're able to focus our processing resources, and that's terribly important for survival. I mean, that is the heart of the reason why you can have intelligent life, because without that, without the ability to focus the brain's resources on one thing, you would have, in order to process the whole world in any kind of depth with any kind of intelligence, you would need a brain the size of, I don't know, a school or something like that. I mean, you need a gigantic brain, but instead what we can do is filter out and throw away almost everything and focus what resources we do have on one tiny piece of the world at a time. And that's the sort of beginning, the essence of what it means to be an intelligent being. So that's kind of a heart of where consciousness emerges from. And yes, we try to study that objectively. We try to study it scientifically. But, of course, there's this larger philosophical sense in which everything we do, everything we see, and everything we feel comes to us through our brains, courtesy of our brains. And our brains are building a reality for us, which is probably not quite accurate. It's a cartoon version of the real world around us.
Well, I understand what you were saying about the philosophical, again, dorm room arguments about, you know, whether the universe ends and what's beyond the ending, those kinds of things. What about philosophically the idea of, you know, like, say, Zen and the art of archery, or the idea of flow, or the idea that you posit in your book, you know, about typing, and my son types like 150 words a minute. He looks at me, he talks to me, and he's still typing. And I wish, you know, I'm glad I gave him those classes. I wish I had taken them. But yes, he's not thinking about typing in the slightest. What about the Buddhist concept of kind of the nothingness context of letting go of the thing that you have spent this book explaining that ties us to normal waking day-to-day reality? What about this concept of, and then leading to enlightenment without any ego, which we really haven't talked about either. What about,
right,
is that something that, I don't mean this in a bad way. Is it something you disregard in your lab?
I've actually had wonderful conversations with Buddhists, and it turns out that our theory is peculiarly similar to some of Buddhist ideas, which I find really interesting. I think kind of at the heart of Buddhism is almost a scientific empiricism, right? Because the heart of Buddhism is looking into yourself and trying to see what's there and trying to think it through for yourself. And so there's this very remarkable empirical, scientific, but introspective way of thinking that emerged, you know, 2,500 years ago, that is Buddhism. So I have a lot of respect for that. I think that in terms of meditation and alterations, altered states of consciousness, these are incredibly fascinating. We're just not there yet. We're still studying the really basic kind of consciousness, like how do you have a subjective experience of a simple stimulus projected onto a screen in front of you. You know, we're really at the basics, the beginnings of this scientific endeavor. So I think there's really interesting, really important philosophical questions that come up from things like meditation or Buddhism that we just haven't been able to address yet. And that's not because we disregard them. It's just we haven't got there yet.
Yeah, and it's funny because I'm not necessarily, I'm spiritual in some sense, but I'm not really a spiritual person, but I've always thought in those kinds of ways. Actually, it's interesting you were talking about it because the Dalai Lama, I think every year, meets with a renowned group of quantum physicists, and each year it seems as if they are growing closer and closer together in their ideas of the way the world works, which I find absolutely fascinating. And, you know, and it's funny, too. It's like, okay, you know, I'm 67 now, and, you know, so some people would say I'm old, whatever, whatever. So, but when I look in the mirror, I only see me. I never see somebody beside me. I don't see myself as old or young. I know those changes have happened, but I don't see that. I just see me. And that's also been something that, I mean, there's three people. There's what I think I look like, what you think I look like, and what I look like. And that's always troubled me too. But what you're saying, I understand completely. You're the mechanic looking under the hood, and I'm just like kind of a driver that wants to know, oh, isn't this car beautiful? Have you seen this or that kind of thing?
Right. So in looking under the hood, I think we're beginning to understand at an engineering level how to build. We're just beginning to understand how to build a machine that has some aspects of consciousness, and the kinds of things that we think we're beginning to be able to build are like consciousness of the color red, you know, like we're at that level.
Yes.
It's really simple. And you as a practitioner of consciousness, the things that interest you are consciousness of yourself and your place in the world and your altered states of consciousness. And these are all really exciting and interesting. But we're still at this really low level. It's almost like as engineers, we're beginning to build a roller skate. And and maybe eventually we'll get to the point of understanding how to build a really beautiful car that you're driving that interests you, you know?
Yeah. Roller skate's good because the old ones, you had a key. So it's funny, but that puts you in the position of someone, say, like, a guy who's building Chartres or the Louvre, and you know that, especially the way you said it in the book about how long it's going to take to reach these goals, you know that it's not going to happen in your lifetime, or perhaps not happen in your lifetime, and then your progeny or their progeny will actually come at some point to solve the problem. Does that make you optimistic? Does it make you feel bad, I'm not going to be there when this happens? Or are you glad just to be paving the way?
Oh, I just enjoy what we're doing at the moment. I think the main goal for me is insight. Just the more we can understand about the world and ourselves is just marvelous and exciting. There is this whole technological side to it that this is I think, and I'm not alone in this, many people think this is kind of our technological watershed. This will change us as a species more than anything else. The moment that we understand consciousness well enough to build it and engineer it, that's the moment we change as a species. There's so many aspects of our civilization that change radically at that point, and that's kind of a scary future, actually. And so there's a part of me that's quite glad I won't be around for that.
And that's what Stephen Hawking said. Yeah, there is a very scary element to it. And it's really nice in the book how you refer to a lot of popular culture and movies and things like that, because I think that gives a lot of people a much better way in to understanding things. Did you do that? I guess you did that, well, obviously you did purposefully, the idea of bringing these things in when you were just talking about Yoda and Darth Vader or the politicians. So I guess
that was
well thought out by you. When I read the book, it really helped out a lot.
Good. I'm glad to hear.
So here I go again. So what about something like, say, Carl Jung writes this book, Synchronicity? And then I'll, not to beat a dead horse. So that's outside of your wheelhouse. You're not interested in things like synchronicity. You have nothing in your lab is going to deal with synchronicity, the idea that these two things come together, there's a ghost in the machine, that kind of thing.
My interest is why people believe there's a ghost in the machine. And so I'm actually very interested in the way people think about that.
Got it. Okay.
And so I tend not to dismiss these views. I don't agree with them, but I'm very interested in why people believe in them, because I think we have kind of built into us, evolution has built into us a tendency to think in those ways. So I find it very fascinating, actually. But yes, I disagree with, I don't think there is a ghost in the machine. I think it's a machine that thinks it has a ghost in it. And there's a benefit, a cognitive benefit, to having that simple self-concept, because it's a lot easier to build that kind of self-concept than an accurate one. Like, if you had an accurate model of yourself, I mean, the brain is 86 billion neurons hooked together with 100 trillion synapses, and to have a scientifically accurate self model is literally impossible. So what the brain does is build these very simplistic self models, like ghost in the machine style self models, and so that really interests me, and beliefs of that nature, spiritual beliefs of that nature, interest me enormously.
Well, it's funny because you've used the word cartoon several times, and that that reminded me of the old image of the mind as being, we replicate reality by having this stage with a proscenium and curtains that open. And that kind of sounds like a cartoon, in a way.
Oh, there's some similarity in there, I think.
Yeah. And that implies, well, again, it's certainly subjective, but it implies that, to me, from my side of the fence, it implies, you know, unreliability. Where from your side of the fence, you're looking to see, you know, where that comes from. What portion of the brain is creating that stage, correct?
Yes, that's right. Okay. So I'm really interested in looking under the hood. And this crucial question comes about with respect to the consciousness, ghost in the machine, soul, spirit, whatever it is. The question I'm really asking, looking under the hood, is, okay, why does this biological machine think all that stuff? Why does it think that about itself? And that's really at the heart what this book is about, tracing that evolution of that all the way from, you know, the beginning of brains all the way up to our present and possibly into our technological future. But basically asking this question, why do information processing machines think some very strange, semi-magical things about themselves?
Well, okay. I can kind of come over to your side of the fence in this one. What are the advantages to us as a species of consciousness? And you talk about that in the book a little bit.
Yes. We think there's probably many advantages, and I outline a whole bunch of them. But one of the more interesting ones goes something like this. usually when people talk about consciousness, they're thinking about their own consciousness. You know, I have an awareness of the world. I look out, I see the world, I experience. But one of the most important ways that people use consciousness, that whole idea, that whole concept, is in attributing it to other people. We see it in other people. We perceive consciousness all around us in people and pets and in all kinds of, I mean, children see consciousness in their toys. And the other day I got mad at my computer, and some people talk to their houseplants and swear that their houseplants are conscious. So we have this social impulse to paint the world as full of conscious minds all around us, conscious presences. And this we think owes itself to people as these hyper-social animals. We evolved to be incredibly social, and there's a utility to that. There's this is evolution solving the problem of how to create a hypersocial, pro-social species where we basically cooperate and get along in really intricate ways. And of course, that's the heart of our success as a species, right? We're successful because we work together. I mean, sometimes we don't so well, and right. We fight with each other, and we have all kinds of interpersonal problems. But by and large, people glom together in groups and work really well together and build things together, and that's what makes us powerful as a species. And the heart of that, the reason why we can do that, is because we look at each other and we project consciousness onto each other. We see each other as conscious. And so this whole ability of the machine to understand itself as a conscious entity and to understand others around it as conscious entities, we think that's at the heart of our social success. So that's one of the most important benefits, I think.
It's funny because you're studying this neural network that you just described with regard to synapses and connections, and what you've just talked about kind of sounds like a neural network, but not a neural network. The nature in which society interacts with itself because of the perception of consciousness from one person to another almost sounds as if you're jumping a synapse.
Yes, it's sort of like a meta network, the social network. The brain is a network of neurons, and we have this meta network of people who interact with each other. It sort of grew on top of the smaller network.
It's funny because...
But I do think that's crucial, and I also think, so there's a discussion, obviously, right now in the media often, there's a discussion of artificial intelligence and its risk and the potential problems with artificial intelligence. And to me, given what we study and given what we see with human consciousness, the biggest problem with artificial intelligence that I can see is that it's basically we're building sociopathic intelligence. We're building incredibly intelligent machines that don't know what consciousness is and don't see it in other people and therefore have no possible capacity to value it. Like I said, consciousness and the ability to see it in other people is evolution's solution to how to build a pro-social cooperative species. And I suspect we need to start thinking about how to build some of that into our artificial intelligence and make it a little bit pro-social as well.
All right, two questions from that. The first is you're calling machines intelligent. So what's your definition of intelligence? Because in my mind, again in my mind, intelligence implies a certain amount of consciousness. But I think you're saying it doesn't, because these machines are intelligent, but they lack consciousness.
So that's right. So first of all, most of what goes on in your head is outside of what you call consciousness. You're just not aware of it. This vast amount of processing that's incredibly sophisticated and leads to incredibly complex behavior, you're just not even aware of it. And when you look across the animal kingdom, I mean, there's all kinds of animals. Plants as well can behave in extraordinarily sophisticated, complex ways. And people have talked about, for example, the incredible complexity of the behavior of honeybees or the incredible complexity of how plants interact via hormones. I mean, there's all kinds of complexity you could call intelligent complexity. A self-driving car is actually a marvel of intelligence because it takes in information, processes it, integrates it, makes decisions, and guides behavior in a rich manner. So intelligence, meaning the ability to process information in a rich and complex manner, that's one thing. But consciousness, meaning I have a subjective experience of it, that's something different.
It's funny because I thought about this yesterday because I was using Google Lens, which allows you to take a picture of an object. And well, actually, I took a picture of the cover of your book. It then shows me pictures of your book, where I can buy it, which is the least expensive price. And I was thinking, what kind of power must there be to allow that to happen? And, you know, it's way beyond anything that I could ever conceive. It's impossible for a human being to conceive of being able to do that. But I never thought of intelligence until just now when you gave that definition.
Right. That's right. It is intelligence. And it rests on the concept of the neural network. So the idea that, which really emerged with the great neuroscientist Ramon y Cajal, who discovered the neuron about a little more than 100 years ago. The basis of at the heart of the brain, there are these separate cells, neurons, and they hook together at synapses, and the synapses gate information among the neurons. And that was a profound insight. All of neuroscience is named after the neuron, and everything we do is within that kind of larger paradigm of the neuron. And now, technologically, that has kind of taken over our world, because it turns out when you build artificial neurons and hook them together into networks, they can do incredible things. I mean, evolution came up with an amazing solution for intelligent information processing. And so all those kinds of algorithms that you use online that are so powerful, that's the result of neural networks that have been trained to do incredibly sophisticated and complex tasks.
Yeah, and it's funny because, like, if you look at, like, one of Ramon y Cajal's drawings of the cells of, like, say, whatever, a cerebellum, it's very similar to the cover of your book, which is a description of a neural network, I assume, right?
Right, yes. Yes.
Yes.
But we live in the age of the neuron.
Well, so let me ask you a question that I think you can answer with regard to the anatomy and the location of certain processes in the brain.
Mm-hmm.
I used to practice law, and I used to be a plaintiff's attorney. And there would be some times where I had already taken the deposition of a medical, it was usually medical negligence. So I would take the deposition of a physician, and so I knew exactly what he was going to say when I asked the questions. Mm-hmm. And so when I was cross-examining that witness, there became a moment when I was in, you know, what they call flow, where I had I was not aware of anything I was asking. I could actually see myself from afar. In front of the witness on the stand, I could actually see that, but there was no mechanism by which I could. There was no thought process involved. So where does that originate? What part of the brain allows me to have done that?
Mm-hmm. It just shows you how much of your brain functions outside of what we think of as consciousness, right? So
yeah.
Vast amounts of intelligent behavior are being orchestrated by huge networks across your brain that are totally irrelevant, or at least temporarily outside of your consciousness. They're there, they're functioning, but they're outside of that little tiny island of stuff that is our conscious mind. I do think maybe that's one of the hardest aspects of consciousness for people to grasp, because they think of themselves and their minds as this vast kind of cloudy thing, but it's tiny. It's tiny compared to all the rest of the stuff going on in your head.
Yeah, I was just basically running a program. What's the name of that guy whose name I can't pronounce who wrote that book, Flow? Do you know what I'm talking about? He's a Polish guy.
I don't remember his name.
And that described that process and how beneficial it was to enter, again, going back to Buddhism, enter into that meditative state where you can, like if you're an athlete, for example, Roger Federer, he's not thinking. If you think about throwing you crumple up a piece of paper and think about aiming it into the trash can, most likely you're going to miss. But if you don't think about it at all, you have a good chance of sinking it.
So the conscious mind, the attentive mind, that focus of attention is really good for new circumstances where you don't really have a good skill set yet and you have to think your way through it and draw on all your resources and figure out what to do next. But once you become really good at something, it becomes automated. It's this automatization. Other parts of the brain take it over. Like riding a bicycle, you become really good at it. Other parts of the brain are taking it over. And when you use that attentive and conscious part of your mind and focus on riding the bicycle, all you're really doing is interfering. You're interfering with all the networks in your brain that have learned the task really well and can do well on their own. They don't need that attentive focus. That just gets in the way. And you can see that same thing going on even at that simple level of if you ride a bicycle and think about exactly how your legs are moving, you'll start falling over. And I think the same thing applies, when you're acting as an attorney and you're in that state of flow and you're using a skill set that you've practiced over and over and become tremendously good at, keep that attentive conscious mind away from it because you'll just interfere with those well-practiced skills.
It's funny, if I straddle both sides of the fence, I took my son to see the last game of the playoffs of the Chicago Bulls against the Utah Jazz, and I had pretty good seats in Utah on a Sunday. And there's Michael Jordan. I see him steal the ball from Moses Malone from the front. Somehow he goes around the back, gets the ball that he's stolen, and then he goes up and he makes that shot that everyone's seen the iconic picture of where he just kind of lifts up his hand and kind of floats it down. And I knew as he took the shot, just as he knew, that ball was going to go in. If there was no one else on the court, it was going in. So here's the straddle part is that I then feel this sense of admiration, of magic, of courage, of this heroic warrior. So, yes, I understand, no ghost in the machine. But he's able to do that because certain portions of his brain are hardwired to allow him to achieve this. He's playing a different game, so obviously, for many reasons, he's talented, the shape of his body, the size of his hands, all those things. But where does that feeling arise in my brain based on this, as you talked about, this social ability to perceive other consciousness? Where does that arise?
We have this wonderful capacity, which has been often studied, of, one word to put on it is empathy. That is, we can put ourselves in the shoes of other people. We imagine what other people must be feeling and how other people are moving. If you watch someone like Michael Jordan, probably your body is unconsciously making little movements and you're kind of almost playing along with him. This is very natural to us, and it's certainly a core part of our social ability. Some people call it simulation because we simulate other people's mind states in ourselves, in our brains, and it's crucial. I mean, if you're sitting around a room and somebody leans back and puts their hands behind their heads, pretty much. You look around and you'll see other people starting to do the same thing unconsciously, because they're all kind of, their brains are busy simulating what the people around them are doing. Or you see someone, fall down and hit their face on the ground, and what do? You cringe, you make a facial expression like the same way that you would if you hit your face. Or you watch a boxing match and you find yourself making little boxing motions with your hand. You feel with other people. If you see someone who is giving a public address and does something really embarrassing, you feel embarrassed, right? So what we're doing is looking at other people and imagining ourselves in that position and simulating what it would be like for us to be there. And that's one of the most important aspects of our social selves.
Yeah, and that goes back to the advantages, because I'm thinking, you know, I went to the Eagles game, there's 70,000 people all rooting. Why are they going there? What are they feeling? Empathy. Why are you going to a Trump rally, in nitwits? Why, you know, or the rallies of Hitler or Mussolini? Sometimes they're bad, sometimes, you know, they're good. Some, you know, or, you know, Mel Gibson in that movie where he's rallying his troops to do the best they can, or in the Spartan movie 300. Now I understand what you're talking about. I didn't before.
Ah.
But, yeah, definitely. Well, we've been talking for over an hour, and you're probably sick of me, but I could ask questions for days of you because it's just so fascinating. And the book is so fascinating, too. And I didn't tell you, I own an independent bookstore here just outside of Philadelphia, and your book is sitting there on our front table, and I recommend it to as many people as I can.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome. So I've enjoyed it very much. Thank you so much, Michael, for taking the time to talk to us today.
Sure. Thank you.
So we were talking with Michael Graziano about his latest book. He's written several about neuroscience. This one is called Rethinking Consciousness, A Scientific Theory of Subjective Experience. And as I said, it's on the front table in Wellington Square Bookshop, which brings you this program unapologetically for the past 7 or 8 years. He removes from me many of the ways I thought about consciousness because he's thinking about it in a completely different way. He's looking at the brain. He's deciding where in the brain, whether it's the occipital lobe or the parietal lobe or the cerebellum or the cerebral cortex or the hypothalamus or the hippocampus. He's thinking, okay, here, I'll put an electrode here and you'll remember taking piano lessons. Or if you get brain injured, you'll forget. Reminds me of that joke where the guy asked the brain surgeon after surgery, will I be able to play the piano? And the neurosurgeon says, I don't see why not. And the guy goes, that's strange. I've never played it before. In any event, join us every week, if you will, on The Avid Reader. As you can tell from today's interview, you can learn a lot, and you can learn a lot about the book before you've read it or after you've read it. And not because of me, but because of the willingness of the authors to come forward and explain these books. It changed the very nature in which your understanding of the book might have been. Did so today for me. In any event, upcoming, other authors that'll do the same thing. Dexter Palmer to discuss his latest book, Mary Toft, or The Rabbit Queen, which has such a weird title that you have to read the book. And then Kylie Reed, who lives in Philly, will stop by to discuss her, what is a highly anticipated debut novel, which won't come out till the end of the year. It's called Such a Fun Age. I've already read it. I've met Kylie and talked to her. We had a great time. And for a debut novel, it's just so good. And when it comes out, buy it. And we'll have it up front, too, as well. So if you need a complete schedule of what we have coming up or what we had in the past, you can go to our website. You can download our podcasts at iTunes or Podomatic. If you go to the podcast app for iTunes, you don't even have to download them. Just listen to them. And in any event, as always, thank you for joining us today, and I hope that you'll come back to listen to our next interview here on The Avid Reader.